So today we come to the end of our current series in Genesis. It's maybe not where I thought we were going to finish, just with all of the changes that have had to be made throughout these past couple of months in September, with how worship schedule has had to be rescheduled and different passages reorganized to fit in. But it actually turns out it's quite a good passage to be finishing on, because this whole series on this Father's Day has been thinking about Abraham. Abraham, the father of all who believe. This isn't just something that is mentioned, well, it's not mentioned in Genesis that we've looked at so far, but it's actually something that thousands of years later is reflected on in the New Testament by recognizing that Abraham is the father of all who believe. And when we think about it, it's been quite a journey for us, as we've taken two big chunks out of the Genesis pie, chunks of a pie that is rich and full of God's provision and mercy for his people. In the first part, from Genesis 1 through to Genesis 11, we saw how all of human history began in the beginning. And in the beginning, Adam and then Eve, in the garden, enjoying the closest of relationships with God and with each other. But then we know Genesis 3 comes along, and that is the moment in history when sin enters the world and everything changes forever. No more could humankind have that close relationship with God as was known in the garden. And from this point in human history of Genesis 3, we see sin on the increase, personified in the line of Cain and his offspring. And as we went through that line, we met one of his offspring called Lamech in Genesis 4. And we saw the depravity to which humankind had fallen. And so in Genesis 4, verses 23 to 24, we read this. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. Lamech actually boasts here in the sin of his forefather. This is the depth of sin that is described here. He's comparing himself to Cain, who murdered his brother. But what Lamech is saying here is that he is willing to become more sinful than his ancestor. This is the depths to which the world had fallen by the time we reached Genesis 4. And the path of sin continues, because as we reach Genesis 11, we come to the story of the city and the tower of Babel. And this is the moment in history when humankind thought of itself in its own terms rather than in God's terms. Because what did they want to do there in verse 4? They said that they wanted to make a name for themselves so that they would not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. What they wanted to do was frustrate God's plans, because God had earlier commanded, there's Babel for you, they wanted to build this because they wanted to frustrate the plan that God had in Genesis 9, verse 1, when Noah and his family came out of the ark. God said, well, he blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. Well, to fill the earth means that you have to go out around the earth. You have to be scattered. You have to purposely move yourself on so that whatever community will come from you has enough space to survive. But that's not what the people of Babel wanted to do. They wanted to do their own thing. They wanted to ignore God. So rather than being scattered, they wanted to build walls to fortify themselves. And they wanted to build a tower that reached up to the heavens so that around them, just like other cities, they could be seen for miles around as being this wealthy and great city. That's not what God wanted for his people. That was not God's best for them. And of course, God was not going to allow that to happen. And what did he do in chapter 11 and verse 9? He said, or it tells us that he confused the language of the whole world and he scattered them over the face of the whole earth. You see, we could read the first 11 chapters of the Bible and think things got off to a bad start and that there is no hope. Humanity just got more evil and evil and evil. Even whenever God sent the flood to punish sin, we then see the people of Babel, the generations afterwards, back to the old tricks that were known before the flood. But yet, in the middle of this spread of sin, we read of some men who truly worshipped God. A moment ago, we mentioned Cain killing Abel. Well, we know that Seth was given as a third child to Adam and Eve, and through the line of Seth comes Enoch. And in Genesis 5 and verse 24, we read that Enoch walked with God, then he was no more because God took him away. Enoch is the only one of the family line of Adam mentioned as a man who walked with God. And to prove that it was a real thing, the writer of Genesis tells us that he was taken to heaven by the Lord. It is then Enoch's great-grandson who is the next man in Seth's line to be described as different from all the rest. Because in Genesis 6 verse 9 we read that Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Noah was someone who had a close relationship with God, and that relationship meant that he would be saved when the flood came upon the earth. So from Noah, through his son Shem, we then come to Abraham. And so, having studied the first people groups in human history and their spread across the world, we've completed the first piece of Genesis in the beginning. So those first 11 chapters tell us about humanity spread across the earth. The second piece now focuses on Abraham. Right from the beginning of the story of Abraham, God made a covenant promise with Abraham, a covenant that would be sealed with the sign of circumcision. And last week we took the time to see how each part of the covenant had been fulfilled, what God had promised, what Abraham had done, and how God had fulfilled the promises that he'd made. And our passage today is the final piece in the fulfillment, because it is here that we discover that Abraham finally owns a piece of the land. And it's a land that his whole family will inherit. So far, he has wandered in the land, camping first at the great trees of Mamre outside Hebron, and now we find him in the southern part of the promised land in the Negev, which is a wilderness. It's a desert. And before we get into looking at chapter 21, the reason why I've looked at Genesis 1 to 21 in that very quick overview is because we need to be reminding ourselves that these are not individual little stories that are just separate from each other. We are beginning to see the golden thread that God is weaving throughout all of the Bible that reveals to us who he is and what his plan for humankind is. And you know, we must keep reminding ourselves of this, because if we start just carving up the Bible into little segments and little stories, then we miss the big picture of what God is doing and how God is revealing that to us, and how one thing links to another, to another, to another, so that we can have the complete story of God. So, we now come to chapter 21. But it's actually a story that began in chapter 20. And it's there that we met the ruler of the land, Abimelech. Now Abimelech, the story of Abimelech, he had been lied to by Abraham, just like Abraham had lied to the king of Egypt years earlier, and had said that Sarah was actually Abraham's sister. So Abimelech took Sarah to be his wife. Now, as we know in the story, God took issue with this, and he appeared to Abimelech in a dream or a vision and told him to give her back to her husband. He did, but he was actually brave enough to call Abraham out on the deceit. And when all the issues are sorted, Abimelech says that in chapter 20 and verse 15, he says to Abraham, "My land is before you. Live wherever you like." So Abraham settles in the west of that land of the Negev, and the promised son Isaac is born. And at the end of chapter 1, we meet Abimelech again. But this time, Abimelech is accompanied by the commander of his forces, Phicol. Now, whether the reason for Phicol accompanying is because of disputes over territory within the land of the Philistines, and Abimelech was trying to show his control of the land that Abraham lived in, or that he simply wanted to make a point with Abraham and Phicol was present to reinforce the issue, quite literally with force, we don't really know. We can only really guess from the text, and to be honest, the text swings one way, the next in what it could mean, and then another way, once again, to the other side. Well, Abimelech begins this passage by recognizing what he already knows, that God is with Abraham. He'd already said this back in chapter 20. But then he goes on to ask Abraham to swear to him. Now, the language that's used here is the traditional language of treaties, of agreements, of promises, of covenants. And what is being asked here means that it would give strength to an argument that Abraham was being used by Abimelech for the purpose of shoring up his control of the territory. So the request from Abimelech is a simple one. He says, "Swear to me, don't deal falsely with me or my children or my descendants, and show the country where you are living as an alien the same kindness that I have shown you." With the language used here, it might be that Abimelech clearly remembers his previous dealings with Abraham. Remember Abraham's deceit, but also God's punishment of infertility of the women of his household, which of course then, because Abraham prayed, that was restored. So Abimelech perhaps wants to keep the peace. And he uses strong language here, almost threatening language, in reminding Abraham that he is a foreigner or an alien in the land. He's not one of us. You're here only because I've allowed you to be here, Abraham. That's the kind of language that we're reading. Well, Abraham's reply is short and simple. Because in Genesis 21, verse 24, we read, "Abraham said, I swear it." That's it. Abraham simply agrees. And so that's the treaty agreed. And in Abimelech's mind, all is well. And just as he turns on his heel to walk away, Abraham has a Lieutenant Columbo moment. I don't know if you ever watched Columbo, that great American TV show that ran from the 1960s right through to the 1990s with Peter Falk starring as Columbo. And what was one of his key words? Just one more thing. Whoever he was investigating had thought that the questions were all over, but Columbo would swing round on his heel and say, just one more thing. And you knew that that was the punch question that was coming. And it actually turns out that Abraham has a one more thing moment, because here we come to the punch moment of this whole interaction. Abraham says that there's just one more thing, because he sees his chance to complain about how Abimelech's men have treated him. Abraham, it seems, has dug a well, but it is a well that has been seized by Abimelech's servants. So by this act, it would seem that Abraham's earlier fear that the men of Gerar had some basis of the fact. Because remember back in Genesis 20, verse 11, Abraham gave us the reason for why he lied about Sarah. Because Abraham replied, "I said to myself, there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife." So it seems that Abraham still has these fears. And so Abraham is wary of the men of the area, because they did not fear God, and now he has been proved correct because they have taken his well. And we have to understand that this is not just an easy issue to solve. It's not like that Abraham can simply just go a half a mile out in the wilderness and dig another well the next day. That's just not what can happen. You see, to seize a man's source of water in an arid land threatened both life and livelihood. So this is a personal attack on Abraham and his family and his household, which includes his slaves. So this is a big issue. Well, Abimelech pleads ignorance about the issue, and he attempts to deflect the accusation by trying to place the onus of the problem on Abraham for not reporting it. Well, Abraham is not convinced that Abimelech has taken his complaint.